Welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is May 13th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Video Kill Direct Laryngoscopy. And we have a guest skeptic, Dr. Steve Carroll. Steve is an active duty emergency medicine physician with the U.S. Army. Welcome to the SGEM, Steve.
Hey, Ken. How you doing?
Can you tell us what it's like to be both a doctor and a soldier?
Sure. So again, my name is Steve Carroll, and I run the EM Basic podcast. And what I try to do is review core emergency medicine topics at the level of a medical student or an intern. I'm currently on the clinical staff at Darnell Army Medical Center in Fort Hood, Texas. And this summer, I'm going to be moving back to San Antonio Military Medical Center to be emergency medicine faculty where I did my residency. So if you've listened to the EM Basic podcast before, you know that I do need to quickly mention that my views are my own and don't represent those of the Department of Defense of the U.S. Army. And since we're going to be talking about a few airway devices, I should also mention that I have no conflicts of interest and I don't take money from anybody. Sorry for those disclaimers, but I'm sure everyone knows I kind of have to say them.
Well, I appreciate that. And just so you know, Canada does have an army and I'm not in it. That was not a joke, okay, Steve? And the other thing is, I don't have any financial affiliations with any of the products we may or may not be discussing on today's podcast as well. So let's start with a case scenario. Lay it on the line for us. Give us some good, juicy information to frame this conversation.
All right, so the case we have today, you're working on a busy Saturday night overnight shift when you get a trauma patient from a rollover motor vehicle accident. The patient is a 21-year-old male who had, quote, just two beers and was speeding at over 90 miles per hour. I'm sorry, 160 kilometers per hour for the rest of the planet.
Thank you for converting that for the rest of the planet. Doesn't that tell you something, Steve?
It does. And no worries. I'm here to help. So he arrives to the ED combative, and it's clear that he has a bad head injury, along with several extremity fractures and a surgical abdomen. It's also clear that he needs to be intubated right now. And as Cliff Reed likes to say, he has a lack of ketamine in his blood. You set up your equipment for the intubation, and one of the nurses asks you, are you going to use direct laryngoscopy or the GlideScope? You ponder this for a second as you prep your other equipment.
Don't you just love it when the nurses sort of drop that? You know, they're so good at prompting us as physicians. Doctor, do you really want to use 10 milligrams of hydromorphone?
Exactly, and especially whenever they say doctor, you know that a suggestion is coming, right?
So what's the question for today's podcast then?
So the question is, in trauma patients, is there any difference in mortality when video laryngoscopy is used for airway management as compared to direct laryngoscopy, or as I like to say, VL versus DL?
So, you know, emergency medicine, Steve, we own the airway. I mean, this is our wheelhouse. I mean, there's a paper by Walls et al. In 2011, and it was a National Emergency Airway Registry, and it showed that 87%, yes, the vast majority of intubations are performed by emergency physicians, but we know this, and more than two-thirds of the time, rapid sequence intubations were performed. Squirrel. I don't know what it says about our attention span. And the initial attempt, and I mean, I think this is great. The initial attempt had a 95% success rate. So we own this, don't we, Steve?
Yeah, we do. It's obviously something that we have to be very good at and something that we have to be able to perform at a moment's notice in the emergency department.
Now, there's been a number of advances in this arena in the last few years, and many of these advances have been new airway management devices. And a variety of them involve video laryngoscopy, tools which are displacing traditional direct laryngoscopy. So you had some papers that you wanted to mention on this to help give some readers a primer on this area.
Yeah, so there's a paper from the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2011 done by first author is Rich Levitan et al. And in
So Steve, I don't have to salute him. He's not an officer. He's an author?
He's an author,
yes. An author. So we're not saluting.
Yeah, sorry. Slip of the tongue there. He did a really great article that really breaks down kind of the differences between direct laryngoscopy and video laryngoscopy. And one of the big points he makes is that, well, first of all, not all video laryngoscopy devices are the same. And this mostly has to do with the shape of the blade. So the traditional Macintosh blade and the way that we use the Macintosh blade for direct laryngoscopy is that we need to create a line of sight between our eye and the patient's larynx. And to do this, we displace some tissue. Now, today we're going to be talking about using the GlideScope. Now, the GlideScope has a very hyperacute angle, and it's designed to kind of give us that really great view of the airway. However, it's not designed to really displace a whole lot of tissue. So what we'll see in some of these papers is that while it gets you that great view, it can sometimes take a little longer to actually pass the tube because it's not actually displacing that tissue. Now, there are other video laryngoscopy devices, such as the CMAC, that you can use as both a VL and DL device, but today we're going to be talking mostly about the GlideScope. Another resource that I think everyone should know is the paper that both Dr. Levitan and Dr. Scott Weingart from the MCRIT podcast wrote in Annals of Emergency Medicine 2012. And here they discuss pre-oxygenation and how to prevent desaturation during emergency airway management. And we'll talk about how we can use that when we use these video laryngoscopy devices a little later.
Yeah, and there's some excellent foamy good resources that are available for free, my favorite price, on this topic. You can get it from Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, Michelle Lynn's site, and you can also find a good pro-con discussion about direct versus video laryngoscopy from those boys down under in the Life in the Fast Lane. But let's move on to the article so we can start discussing that. Which article did you pick for the SGEM episode?
So I picked the article titled Effective Video Laryngoscopy on Trauma Patient Survival, a Randomized Controlled Trial from the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, August 2013.
All right, let's go through the PICO here quickly. What was the population that they were looking at?
So they were looking at trauma patients at the Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore, Maryland, USA.
And then the intervention, I think you already alluded to this, that they were using video laryngoscopy using the equipment, the GlideScope, right?
Right.
And they were comparing it to?
Direct laryngoscopy.
And what was their outcome that they were concerned with?
So their primary outcome was mortality, and their secondary outcome was survival among subgroups, duration of intubation attempt, desaturation during the procedure, and first pass success rates.
So that's a pretty good primary outcome. I mean, that's pretty patient-oriented, you know, alive or dead, and hard to fudge, too.
Exactly. I mean, this is the outcome we really kind of all care about. But the secondary outcomes, I think we should care about as well, although, as we'll talk about, the study may have not really been powered for them.
Okay, so we'll give the author's conclusions, and then we'll start breaking down this paper. The author's conclusion was, quote, video laryngoscopy and direct laryngoscopy were similar for mortality. Post-hoc analysis showed possible increased mortality in those with the most severe head injuries who were randomized into the video laryngoscopy group. End of quote. Now, Steve, we have a quality checklist. It's one of the best evidence in emergency medicine tools, and we use this for randomized clinical control trials. And so I was going to ask you, with your military precision, and Steve, what's your rank?
I'm a captain.
Sir, yes, sir. Okay, so captain, my captain, what I'm going to go through is those 11 questions, and if you could just give us the answers to these 11 things, and then we'll move on to the results.
Sure.
So question number one, were these emergency department patients?
Yes, but only the most injured get transferred to Shock Trauma Center, so these may be a little more injured than your average patients that come to the ED.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on which environment you work in. If you're working in a shock trauma center, I guess they might be relevant to you. But in a general emergency department or a community emergency department or a non, a level one trauma center, these may not represent the patients you see in your department. Question two, were the patients adequately randomized?
Yes.
Was the randomization process concealed?
Yes.
Were the patients analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yes.
Were they recruited consecutively?
No, and this is something we'll talk about.
Ah, very interesting. So not consecutively recruited. Question number six. Were patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
Were patients unaware of their allocation?
No.
So they knew which group they were in. Okay. Were groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
Was the follow-up complete, Steve?
Yes, it was very complete, actually.
And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Yes.
And was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Unfortunately for this case, no.
All right. Thanks for going through that so quickly. Now let's get to the key result. The primary outcome was mortality. What was the result?
The mortality between the VL and the DL groups was exactly the same.
So it didn't matter whether you used video laryngoscopy or direct laryngoscopy, right?
Right.
All right. How about those secondary outcomes you thought, you know, important to talk about?
So the one thing that this study showed, and just to make this clear, they actually used a video review of every resuscitation to record these results. So you know that this isn't subject to chart bias, you know, different recordings later on. So one of the secondary outcomes is that video laryngoscopy resulted in a longer time to intubation. It took 56 seconds to intubate in the VL group versus 40 seconds in the DL group.
I wonder how important 16 seconds is. I could probably hold my breath for 16 seconds, but I don't know how important 16 seconds would be for a patient-oriented outcome. I'm not sure. Okay, what else did they have?
So they also showed that in a post hoc analysis, so a big data dredge, that those patients with the most severe head injuries had a higher mortality and more frequent desaturations below 80%. So 50% in the VL group versus 24% in the DL group. So, however, this wasn't included in the original study design. This was something they data dredged after the fact.
Oh, my EBM spidey senses are tingling already. Anything else?
And finally, the first pass success rate was the same in both groups at 80%.
All right, let's start editorializing this a bit then. It was a well-done study. I mean, and it was asking an important question because this has certainly come up in the environment of emergency medicine. Should we be doing video versus direct laryngoscopy? The strengths included the fact that it was a randomized trial and all patients were followed up for the primary endpoint. And of course, the study used video, like you mentioned, to record the resuscitations to avoid any bias inherent in a chart review. But you did say that there was a significant weakness. Let's talk about that, Steve.
Sure. So the big weakness in the study was that the attending physicians were permitted to not enroll some eligible patients if they didn't want to take part in the study. So this could have introduced some significant selection bias in the fact that the attending physicians may have had the more difficult airways not been included due to them wanting to use one technique over the other.
Yeah, this is a really significant weakness, isn't it? We like to see people that are randomized, and of course we like to see them blinded, but consecutive patients are so important. Once we start cherry picking, it really throws into question the validity of the final results.
Yeah, it does. And in this case, they excluded somewhere around 25% of possibly eligible patients based on attending preference.
Did they explain these exclusions or did they talk about that, you know, the type of patients that were excluded? Were they much different than the patients that were included?
So according to the authors, the patients that were excluded weren't that different from those that were included in the group. And they also pointed out that there were that most of the exclusions were due to only a handful of anesthesiologists that had very poor enrollment throughout the study site.
So they blame the anesthesiologist, did they? It's like, yeah, well, those guys just
blamed a few of them, a few key ones, I guess.
They just didn't want to play ball with the rest of the team?
No, I guess not, at least not for this study. One other thing is that, I mean, technically the treating physicians knew which groups the patients were assigned to, but that's not really a concern because it's really impossible to conceal whether you're using the GlideScope versus direct laryngoscopy for a patient. So that's not a really big concern. So I think as far as I'm concerned, this study leads some support that video laryngoscopy is at least as useful as direct laryngoscopy when intubating trauma patients.
Well, I always like to bring it down to a bottom line. And, you know, I think that video laryngoscopy leads to the same outcome as direct laryngoscopy in trauma patients if the attending physician is, of course, allowed to pick their patients. The video laryngoscopy did take a little bit longer and may be associated with higher mortality in patients with severe head injuries. However, this relationship would really require more study to confirm this as a hypothesis.
I agree, Ken.
How about the case resolution? You brought up the case. Can you finish up the case for us, Steve?
So for the case resolution, you decide to use the GlideScope in this case because you feel as if it might be better since the patient is in cervical collar. Knowing that the GlideScope may take a little longer to pass the tube, you're sure to properly pre-oxygenate the patient with high flow oxygen on a non-rebreather mask at 30 to 60 liters per minute and use a nasal cannula at 15 liters per minute kept on during your intubation attempt. You get an excellent view with the GlideScope and pass the tube on your first attempt with no desaturations.
Hey, you just brought up a clinical pearl right at the end there, Steve. I really like the fact that you talked about leaving a nasal cannula with 15 liters of oxygen going while you're doing the intubation. I think that's a real clinical pearl that, you know, many of us should pick up on, and we should start doing this routinely.
I agree, Ken, and that was one of the papers I mentioned earlier. And one final point about this study was that, you know, they had a decent percentage, I believe somewhere around 25% of their patients desaturate below 80%, more in the video group than the direct laryngoscopy group. However, this paper was done before the no desat techniques were really published. So you kind of wonder whether you would have gotten the same results if they've been routinely using high-flow nasal cannula during their intubation attempts.
Well, I think, you know, any paper has flaws. And despite the flaws, I think that from a clinical application standpoint, this supports the use of video laryngoscopy in trauma patients. What do you tell patients?
So I would tell a patient if they happen to ask that I think video laryngoscopy is at least as good as direct laryngoscopy for securing airway in trauma patients.
Great. Let's move on to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Jake Turner. He knew that the most common cause of scapular winging is paralysis of the serratus anterior muscle. This week's Keener contest is going to be about the theme music for this episode. Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles music video was made famous on August 1st, 1981. Yes, some 1980s music trivia. Why is this song so famous? If you know the answer, then email me, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. And you know what, Steve? For being a guest on the SGEM, I'm going to send you a cool skeptical prize.
Awesome, Ken. Look forward to receiving it.
You know, I really appreciate you coming on. I know that you're busy down there at Fort Hood, and then you sounded like you've got a move coming up in your life, so that always throws things into a bit of a commotion.
Oh, happy to do it, Ken.
Would you be kind enough to give the Skeptic's Guide tagline then?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.